There's an old saying, sometimes you get the bear, and sometimes the bear gets you. In Baldur's Gate 3, sometimes you get the bear, and the bear gets you. Welcome to Triple Click, where we bring the games to you. Today we're talking about the Baldur's Gate series in honor of the pending release of Baldur's Gate 3. We've got some history, some D&D chat, and some early impressions of the new game. So grab your D20, and let's get into it. I'm Kirk Hamilton.
I'm Maddie Myers.
And I'm Jason Schreier. Hello.
Hello.
Hope you both have your 20-sided die and you're ready to roll
mine are actually performance checks. Right here. I could do some skill checks right now.
Can you roll one? Can you do a performance check right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, let's get a little foley.
Let's do a performance check to see if you can keep going with this podcast or if we have to stop right now.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what was I rolling against?
Us what you got and then we'll tell you if you pass.
I rolled a 17. Yeah, so I have a proficiency in podcasting. Yeah, that's like a plus four.
You have some additional numbers you can stack on top of there. Yeah, for
that's
sure.
That's a good one. How about people roll to see how much they're going to subscribe to Max Fun? Like how much they're going
to
give?
You have to roll
to
for that
members?
Or do you just check your bag and see how much gold you have?
Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to roll a persuasion check right now and we're going to see if I can persuade you to become a member of Maximum Fun and support our podcast, which means we get to keep making podcasts and you get to listen to monthly bonus episodes from our show and support our worker-owned co-op network, Maximum Fun. And look at that. I rolled a natural 20. Can you believe it? So you're all convinced. I just convinced everybody that was a natural
Jedi
20.
Mind
That's
trick.
a critical success.
Can you actually roll and see what you get?
No. I mean, I did roll. Sorry, Jason. 20. I did. I got a 20. So MaximumFun.org/
I didn't hear any dice.
Yeah, I didn't either, but
that's where you're
going
to go. It was to the side of the mic. Anyways, MaximumFun.org/join. Go become a member, because if you do, you support our show and you get bonus episodes. We just did one on Silo, and we talked some about post-apocalyptic storytelling, which was a lot of fun. And we're kind of building up a little canon of post-apocalyptic stories that we've covered in the bonus episodes. So it was a nice kind of roundup of a lot of those ideas. Also a cool show and a fun one to talk about. And this month, of course, we are going to be doing a big old beans cast where we spill the beans on The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. I haven't finished yet. Jason has. We're finally going to do it, though. We're all going to finish. Maddie hasn't finished either.
We're going to get to the end of that game. It's not for lack of trying. It's just such
There's
a good
lot.
Game.
There's
How could I ever want to leave, you know?
I feel the same way. So we're gonna finish the game. We're going to talk about the story. We'll just talk more about that game since there's much more to say now that we've all played a whole lot of it. So that'll be out toward the end of August. But there's a million bonus episodes that you can listen to. Okay, not a million. There's like 38 of them, but there's a lot of them.
Close enough.
It's kind of like a million, yeah.
It's the
way
podcast
more than
equivalent.
20.
Of a million. So go listen to those and if you're a member. And if you want to become a member, go to MaximumFun.org/join. And thanks so much to everybody who makes this podcast possible. Okay, Jason, what are we talking about this week?
This week, it is time for a What's the Deal With? What's the Deal With?
Dun, What's dun, the dun. Deal with?
What is the
What's
deal?
The deal with? Boom, boom, Baldur's Gate. What's the deal with Baldur's Gate? So this
what
week
is
the release on PC of Baldur's Gate 3. Console releases are coming down the line, but for now it's on PC. And Baldur's Gate 3, kind of against the odds, has turned into one of the most hyped games of this year, even though it's kind of a crunchy role-playing game that you wouldn't think would be that. So what we're going to do today is explain how we got here. How did we get to this D&D nerd game becoming one of the biggest role-playing games of 2023? What is Baldur's Gate? Who's Baldur's Gate? When is Baldur's Gate? What is the deal with this whole thing? And also, we're going to talk a little bit about some early impressions of Baldur's Gate 3, which I have been playing. Maddie has played a little bit, and Kirk has created a character.
Which is
I just did. I just got back in town, and I made a character.
Excellent. So we'll talk about that a little bit later, but first, we're going to zoom out and talk about Baldur's Gate in general. So,
are we zooming out to an isometric view? Are we,
yes,
are
we
pressing
we are
WASD to advance really far around the map just to see where we could
just
go?
Just to see where we can go.
Yep.
So, Baldur's Gate is kind of an interesting franchise. It's the first game was released in 1998, and it was developed by, at the time, a little known company called BioWare. It was published by Black Isle and Interplay, and they kind of, some of the folks from Black Isle helped work on the game as well. And so Baldur's Gate, so back in the 90s, there was a moment in time, a few year period, when everybody kind of hated RPGs. RPGs didn't sell well. There weren't a lot of good ones. There are a lot of bad ones. D&D especially, there were a lot of games with the D&D license that were just not very good, including another one from Interplay that was released around the same time as Baldur's Gate, called Descent to Undermountain, and bad video game. And so when Baldur's Gate came, nobody expected it to be much of a hit. In fact, Interplay's or Black Isle's boss, Fergus Urquhart, who would later go on to found Obsidian Entertainment, he said in an interview at one point that, like, they didn't expect it to sell anything. They expected like 50,000 copies to be sold. Instead, it became this sensation. And the reason it became a sensation and ultimately wound up selling millions of copies is because it was really, really good. It was kind of this authentic role-playing game with like a big meaty world and D&D rules, and you could go around and you form a party and you could talk to people and go on quests and like explore. And it just felt like there was this sense of mystery, the sense of wonder, the sense that you could go to any map and find just about anything. Like, you could find all sorts of fascinating things. It was really one of the earliest games to evoke the same feeling you might feel now while playing, I don't know, a Skyrim or a Zelda. And it was in many ways a successor to the Ultima series, which had kind of tapered off by this point. Ultima 7, I believe, was considered like one of the last great ones.
Yes.
And yeah, Baldur's Gate. So it was, I think, one of the real big revelations, and one of the reasons it was such a big success was this unique combat system it had, where it was real time, but you could also pause, which was pretty revolutionary for the time. So you could pause at any time and assign your character's marching orders, or you could just watch it all unfold in real time. So it kind of had that really best of both worlds in terms of like real time and turn based, which at the time also turn based was kind of out of fad in this era in 1998. So yeah, I mean, from there we went to Baldur's Gate 2, which really took that formula and just like totally blew it up and made it into this epic experience, and also gave you higher level characters, which as D&D players know is much more fun because it opens up a lot more possibilities, a lot of higher level spells. If there was a big knock on Baldur's Gate 1, it was that it was super hard because you were so low leveled and everything around you could kill you at any time. And then from there, we went to Baldur's Gate 2 Throne of Baal, which is the expansion pack, although really it's more of a trilogy. You guys didn't play any of those games, correct?
Mm-mm.
No, I played Neverwinter Nights and Planescape Torment, but I did not play Baldur's Gate. Though, over the weekend, I finally watched a sort of story summary video on Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 that we can maybe put in the show notes, and that was really cool. It made me think I would have really liked those games, but I didn't play them at the time.
Yeah, I don't know how well they've aged, especially when you're playing modern Baldur's Gate 3, but yeah, they were awesome at the time. I mean, I remember when I first played Baldur's Gate 1, it came in this thick package with like a big instruction manual with all the D&D rules, and then the sleeve that had, I believe it was either 6 or 5 CDs, which was like, oh my god, like this game is shipping on 6 CDs. What
I bet that smells amazing. I bet if you
smelled
what
like
that
parchment
sleeve smelled like, it would take you immediately back to the first moment that you opened the box.
Yes, I bet I still have the
disc.
It's
like new car smell, but for games. New game smell. That paper. Good
that plasticky
stuff.
Yeah, and you know, you knew you were in for a treat when you picked up a new computer game and it was 6 CDs.
And it
CDs.
Had that many discs? Oh boy. Man. These days they brag about word count and like gigabytes, but come on, put it on the CDs or we don't understand how big it is, you know?
And then the game unfolded in like map screen. So you start off on one big map screen in the city called Candlekeep, and then you move to new ones as you go. And I remember being totally like blown away when I got to the titular city of Baldur's Gate, and it was like seven map screens, like all connected to each other. It was like mind blowing. It was, I think it was two different cities just for that one city, Baldur's Gate. So yeah, the scope of it was mind boggling, and just like everything really worked together really nicely. It was really well written. And of course, it would go on to lead to the entire, the BioWare RPG as we know it, Mass Effect and Dragon Age were both kind of separate kind of branches on the tree of that all started with Baldur's Gate. I guess it wasn't BioWare's first game, that was Shattered Steel, but it was the first game that really led to BioWare RPGs as we know them. And then something interesting happened with the Baldur's Gate series, which is that there was a Baldur's Gate 3 in development at Black Isle and Interplay, but Interplay had kind of a meltdown, and I won't get into all the details here, but essentially Baldur's Gate 3 got canceled, Interplay shut down, and the series just kind of languished for a while. At a certain point, a company called Beamdog, which was made up of a few ex-BioWare folks, they came out with some re-releases of Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, enhanced editions, they called them, which you can get on Steam. And if you're going to play the games today, those are the versions to get because they feel a little bit more modern.
Are
designed for modern computers with HD graphics and stuff. Beamdog, as well as several other companies, tried to make a Baldur's Gate 3, but for whatever reason, Wizards of the Coast, the makers of D&D, the licensed operator, did not want to let them do it. I think Brian Fargo tried to get the license at one point. I think, if I remember correctly, Obsidian might have. Point being, various like RPG developers wanted to do it, but nobody could. And then enter a little studio called Larian. So this is where we get into modern history. Kirk, do you want to talk a little bit about kind of Larian with Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 and how they kind of broke onto the scene? Because you played those games. You played the first game, right? Divinity Original Sin 2, or 1, Larian's kind of breakout hit in 2014?
Yes. That was the game that broke out to me. There were people who liked the Divinity series. They had made Divine Divinity, Divinity 2. There had kind of been a bunch of games set in this world that were all slightly different kinds of RPGs, if I'm remembering correctly, but I didn't play any of them. I'd sort of been aware of them. They existed in that space of PC role-playing games that look like the games you played in the 90s that you've never really, that you're not aware of if you're just sort of following mainstream gaming and you're not a more sort of niche RPG player. And then I saw something about Divinity Original Sin. It might have just been, I think it was maybe like a Rock, Paper, Shotgun interview with Sven Vinky, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
Head of the studio. I believe it was him talking about how inspired he was by Ultima 7, specifically Ultima 7 Part 2 Serpent Isle, which is a game that I poured hours into when I was in high school in the 90s and really loved. And, you know, he was talking a lot about systemic role-playing games and having every item, you know, be accounted for in the game. And, you know, I think I saw some screenshots where they had the little pop-up bag that is like your backpack that looks like a backpack but then has a grid inside of it, and they were dragging it around on the screen or something. And I remember thinking,
and you were sold. You were like, grid.
Yeah,
grid
I was
backpack.
Like, this is what I want. Because sometimes it really is those little aesthetic markers that tell you that the game is what the game is going to be. And in this case, I think it really did. So I downloaded it on a total lark. I don't even really remember making the decision. Started playing it and immediately was just, you know, really bowled over by it. This was Divinity Original Sin. This was in, I guess, 2014. It might have even been in early access before the game, you know, was finally released. But it was kind of right before the full release of the game. So earlier in that year that it was released. So yeah, I played a bunch of it and just loved the hell out of it. I almost beat it. I don't know if I finished it. It's sort of similar to what we've said about Divinity Original Sin 2, where it sort of loses steam past a certain point. Mm-hmm. But it has that same magical feeling. It had that same magical feeling for me where it's so simulated and complex while you're playing through the story that it kind of feels magical whenever the story actually continues and responds to you. Someone appears, you get teleported to a new dimension, like real story stuff is happening. It kind of feels more like it's happening in a real world because you've spent so long moving through this dense simulation instead of just moving along what's clearly a pre-written track. So it had that kind of magic, and I really liked it. And then, of course, they released Divinity Original Sin 2, and this was sort of the they definitely had become much more noteworthy. A lot more people were aware of them in the space between the first Divinity Original Sin and then the sequel. And then they released a director's cut of that, which is out on consoles, and you can play. They added a ton of voice acting. Like, they've kind of just been gradually going from niche, kind of, you know, isometric old-school role-playing game to more modern BioWare-style role-playing game, what you would call BioWare-style. And by that, I mean specifically Dragon Age Origins, the Dragon Age series. A kind of more voiced, more, you know, a lot more voice acting, a lot more drama, a little less crunchy and a little more accessible, though still pretty crunchy.
Yeah, DOS 2 was pretty crunchy. Baldur's Gate 3 is pretty crunchy, too. Yeah, I mean, the thing about these
D&D is pretty crunchy, right?
It is. D&D is super crunchy. I mean, the thing about Larian's games, in contrast to the isometric, the Baldur's Gate, original Baldur's Gate trilogy that I talked about earlier, is that Larian's games give you a lot more verbs. And when we talk about systemic, we're really talking about abilities to interact with the world in ways that aren't just like moving around and talking to people and fighting with people. And that, I think, is what really made them feel special to a lot of people. That and the combination of that and kind of choice, player choice, and getting to kind of choose different options, quests, and solve quests in different ways, which is part of that BioWare style. That blended with the systems, I think, is a really potent combination that made DOS 1 and then DOS 2 especially work really well for a lot of people. And so, for example, I mean, you can kill pretty much anybody in the game and the game will interact to that. You can throw a barrel of oil at the ground and then light it on fire and watch a massive fire burn. In Baldur's Gate 3, for example, I mean, I just did this little quest thing in Act 1, which is all I'm up to, so it's all early access stuff that people will have been able to play already, so don't worry too much about like spoilers or anything, but I just did this little quest thing where like I got to this house and there was this raging fire inside the house, and like as I did stuff the fire would continue and I would watch these fireballs explode and like burn furniture and like burn up the entire house, and so I did move quickly before that happened. So that sort of like interactivity with the world is really interesting, I think. Maddie, you haven't played any of these games, right?
No, Baldur's Gate 3 is my first one, and it is a lot crunchier than I expected it to be, and I'm having a really good time with it, but the learning curve is pretty high. I definitely was like, wow, I didn't realize how many buttons there were going to be on the screen. It was bringing back a little bit of StarCraft 2 for me. Lots to read, lots to do, and also, as Jason said, lots of different verbs that you can do for everything. Like, you can press control and decide what you want to do. You can attack a barrel or you can search a barrel. You can attack a guy or attack a door or lockpick a door or try to push the door or click on another person in your party and ask them to lockpick the door. It's like you can just be standing in front of a door for 20 minutes just kind of figuring out what you want to do with the door. I mean, that's D&D, baby. It's really taking me back to the last time I played D&D, which was a decade ago.
You know, even from making my character, I've definitely already noticed that they are using a much simplified version of D&D compared with Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, which I think was second edition and was also the version of D&D that I learned on, which was very, very complicated. And Baldur's Gate 3 is using 5th edition, which is the same rule set that I've been using actually in my actual real-life D&D group.
That's the current version.
That is the current version. And it's been great for me, partly because I've been playing that version of D&D in real life, and that really does help.
Oh, I bet,
When I started playing D&D with this group a year and change ago, I had a similar feeling, Maddie, where I really felt unprepared, and a lot of them had been doing it. My friends who play had been playing already, or they had just, they do their homework more than I do. I'm just, it always makes me feel unprepared. So it's taken me a long time to remember how everything works. But now that I do, it made it a lot easier actually to even just roll a character in Baldur's Gate 3, because a lot of that is because 5th edition has been significantly streamlined compared to, you know, 2nd edition back when they were making the first two games.
Yeah, I mean, those games were, talking about crunchy.
It's pretty absurd.
I mean, there was this concept called THACO, to hit armor class zero. It's an acronym. And basically meant that the lower your armor number, the better it was. It was the most like
counterintuitive
system. Yeah, it was so silly.
Right.
No, big numbers are supposed to be good.
Exactly. That's the only thing that makes sense. So yeah, this makes D&D 5e is way, way better. It makes way more sense. They get rid of alignments, which makes things a lot more fun. But let's get into Baldur's Gate 3. But first, to just kind of set the scene here. So after all of those years and years, really like 16 years of no Baldur's Gate 3 from 2001 to 2017, suddenly DOS 2 comes out. Larian is really establishing itself as like one of the better RPG developers in the world. They're based in Belgium, by the way, although they have studios all over these days in six different countries. So Wizards of the Coast comes to them and says, hey, we want you to make Baldur's Gate 3. They start working together on this idea, and they come up with a concept. It comes out in early access in October of 2020. And then 3 years later, it is finally entering real release after a number of obstacles, including, I just spoke to Sven last week about some of this stuff, the studio blowing up from 140 people to 450, which is... Talk about growing pains.
Wow. I thought you were going to say the studio blowing up. And I was like, wow, that is a serious obstacle to overcome.
I mean, they used to be in seven countries, and then the war in Ukraine started, and they shut down their St. Petersburg office in the first week and relocated everybody from
there. So possibly closer to reality.
COVID hurt them a lot. And the biggest change from Divinity Original Sin 2 to Baldur's Gate 3, other than the name and the D&D and stuff, is that in Baldur's Gate 3, every single conversation takes place with like full cinematic style. So you're getting close-ups of the characters. It's like playing Dragon Age Inquisition or whatever, Mass Effect, where you're like seeing every character's faces. So normally the game takes place through more of a zoomed out isometric style, but then for every conversation you really get in close and you see people's reactions, which is why the game took so long and why they needed so many people. So here we are. Baldur's Gate 3 is out. People are very, very excited for it because of the game's pedigree and because of Larian's kind of experience in recent years and people getting really, really into Larian's games. So what do we all think about it? So Maddie, you were finding it a little bit complicated to start.
I have a question just to start. So would you two say that Baldur's Gate 3 is more similar to Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 or more akin to Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 and 2.5? Because I have no point of comparison for it.
It
other
is
than that it looks kind of like Diablo to me, but it's not like Diablo at all.
No, it's not like, it's only the camera angle. It's like Diablo.
Yep, that's
no,
right.
It is 100% Divinity Original Sin 2 with D&D mechanics.
Okay. So perhaps people who didn't play those two games, or three, it's Baldur's Gate that has the 2.5. People who didn't play Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 and have just been chilling out waiting for Baldur's Gate might play Baldur's Gate 3 and be like, what the heck is going on? That's just an interesting experience for those people, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it'll feel familiar if you've played some of the old isometric role-playing games like Planescape Torment or Icewind Dale or Baldur's Gate, any of those games. It'll feel familiar, but yes, but the idea of like systems and like seeing barrels everywhere that you can throw and they do things and interacting with acid and fire and water and electricity, all that stuff is straight out of Larian's previous games.
Totally. And that stuff actually reminds me of Marvel's Midnight Suns, which is a game that only Kirk and I played, but other people should check out. We did make Jason play it for a couple minutes at least, where you can interact with the environment a lot and like set up a shot. I'm really enjoying that aspect of the game so far. I'm only about 3 hours in, but I've already begun to understand like pushing enemies into stuff is a big part of combat, which I really liked about Marvel's Midnight Suns. It's something that made it a little bit more complex than XCOM, at least for me, and more fun, is just using environmental attacks, thinking about angles and spacing on top of the abilities of each character in each position. That's something that's really fun and also kind of reminds me of the improvisational nature of playing D&D, which is something we talked about a lot last week, and how that dream of having that improvised battle of, oh, right, there was a chest over there. Can I go grab something from there? Can I use that? Can I throw this object that I have? Like that idea of just being able to use anything and everything. I mean, it's not perfect in any way, but I'm already starting to see that aspect, and I'm super into that so far.
Yeah, it's incredibly fun to play around in the environment and to figure out how you can use different spells, the different effects, and how your choices kind of just act in dialogue with the world. It's incredibly fun. So let's talk about how we're approaching this.
Yeah, should I say
this.
What character
what
I
are
mean?
Characters? Like a, yeah, we gotta ask. Do that, right? So what is your what is your main character?
So I'm a half-orc barbarian, shocking no one at all. She's amazing. She's just a one-to-one recreation of me, personality-wise, physical appearance-wise. As you guys know, race-wise. I have those huge, huge fangs, green skin.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it was very, very fun to design the visuals of the character, too. I mean, that's something that I'm sure people have already talked about elsewhere, but I was
really
like, damn, I can really like, I mean, there's only a couple body types, I'll say that, but beyond that I was like, wow, I can really be any shade of green or a non-green shade, but I definitely wanted to go green, or I can have a billion hairstyles. I love that. I was very into making my barbarian look extremely freaking cool, and I didn't know if that would matter, but then seeing what Jason described, like all the close-ups, it's very Dragon Age, which I did play the Dragon Ages and the Mass Effects and loved them. And so having those character close-ups and getting to see like my character's facial expressions to like match the dialogue I'm choosing, and then feel like she's really connected to the world, even though I designed her completely, like that's very cool to me. I like being able to design someone and then have them be just plopped into the world, and there's no friction there. She just is right there along with all these other completely bespoke NPCs that I'm buddies or frenemies with.
Yeah, this is a game where it really matters what your character looks like, because you're going to be seeing them a lot.
Yeah, constantly. Scenes.
So Kirk, you are just the character creator.
Yeah, what'd you make?
Did you play in early access at all, or is this your first time playing?
Nope, I have totally avoided it because I don't know. I've done that a lot with Larian games where I play early access and then, you know, it's always sort of a slow start.
And it all gets taken away when it launches again.
Yeah, because you lose
again.
Your progress.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Although this and, one, you know. I will say, having played in early access, this one is 3 years later, so you do forget a lot of it. But yeah, go on.
So I'm playing as a bard, half-elf bard. Got to get those charisma bonuses. I really want to play a charismatic character this time around, because I think, well, something that I found in Divinity Original Sin 2 is that a lot of the most interesting stuff happens in dialogue, which I suppose makes sense. That something you were getting at, Jason, is that they allow for a lot of choice in these games, and they're all about choice. It's about doing more than just combat and sneaking, basically, which is what a lot of role-playing games do. And I think that a lot of the most interesting systems tend to take place in dialogue, which makes sense, because dialogue is, you know, it's a written version of the same kind of talking of communication that D&D is built out of. Like, really all you need is text, and you could do a whole role-playing game. So in a game with a lot of text that's taking place, you know, it's you're talking to people, but you're also getting prompts, and, you know, there's sort of storytelling going on in the prompts that you're given, in the sort of things you're trying to do. Like, you can use your different proficiencies in conversation in different ways. This is in Divinity Original Sin 2, and I'm assuming it works the same way in Baldur's Gate 3, where if you have a proficiency in intimidation or persuasion, you're going to take different paths, and I'm assuming sometimes get different outcomes based on the way you go through the conversation. So,
well,
I really am in.
Well, pause for a second. It's D&D, so you're rolling a dice. You're literally rolling a d20, and you see.
Yeah, yeah.
Dice.
Oh, okay. I know. I've played enough to see that. Yeah, I mean, I'm getting there, but it's that same idea. So, I think that that's really cool. Like that gives the most interesting options, as opposed to just someone with a lot of cool combat abilities. Because really, everyone has cool combat abilities. And I know from Divinity Original Sin 2 that it's all about the party anyways. I mean, like the party that I built in that game, I customize everyone's classes, I guess, in that game. But I had, you know, it didn't really matter what class my character was. It was more about the party. And I wound up being happy that I picked, in my view, the most interesting character in that game, who is Losa, who's a bard. She, you can like make your own backstory if you want, but there are these pre-written backstories in Divinity Original Sin 2 that I think is the same. You can kind of do something similar in Baldur's Gate. Mm-hmm. But anyways, what was cool about Losa was that she has this evil spirit inside of her that is just terrifyingly powerful. And everyone who she goes to try to figure out what it is, like, gets really scared. She's sort of a medium. She like through her whole life, she's always had spirits just turning up sometimes, and they come and go, and it's like part of her life. And she's this famous entertainer who goes around singing and always has just sort of different people coming into her mind to talk to her. But then someone has turned up who is like not that, like who's way more powerful. And the whole her whole story is finding out who it is and trying to figure out what she's going to do and how she's going to become free. And it winds up being really cool. It reminds me of Disco Elysium.
Yeah.
It's this whole story of like this other person inside of you. You have all these inner conversations. Sometimes that like expresses itself in role-playing moments where you're trying to do something to threaten that entity and it's like stopping you, and it plays out really cool. You can have skill checks against yourself where you'll go evil and attack everybody. Mm-hmm. So I can tell that's already going to be at play with everybody's character in Baldur's Gate, because you have this like mind flayer worm in your brain. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning, it does seem as though they took that idea and they were like, okay, that was the coolest character in our last game. Let's just make every character have that element to themselves. Anyways, long story short, these are the reasons I'm excited for this game and why I wanted to play a very dialogue, persuasion, charisma-heavy character, which I know is the bard just from, you know, obviously it's the bard. And so it'd be fun also to, like, carry around a lute and, like, play my lute for people. That just seemed like it would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah, the bard, I think, is a really good class, but I will say that in this game, it's actually a little bit more like Disco Elysium than it is like Divinity Original Sin 2, because it's a little bit more like D&D in the sense that as you're going through the game and you're going through dialogue options, oftentimes there are four different checks that you could potentially go through. And yep. So you can decide based on what your character is best at, what you want to roll. You can also start conversations with different members of your party or start actions with different members of your party, depending on what you want to, which skill they are best at. So I've been playing, I think I've logged like 12 hours into this full release, 1.0 release, like whatever, the final version of the game. So far in the past couple of days since I got an early copy. We're all playing on early copies, by the way, provided by Larian. And I am playing as a half-elf sorcerer with a subclass. You eventually get, when you hit level 3, you get to like pick a subclass for whatever your class is. And my subclass is crazy cool. It lets me it gives my character a bonus action every time I cast a spell, so I can cast a spell and then use fly to just kind of like jump up in the air and go wherever I want afterwards.
Nice.
And sorcerer is a really fun class just because you get access to a lot of different spells and you don't have to worry about scrolls and stuff. You can just kind of pick what spells you want, and so you can blast apart everybody with magic missile. And I will say that after 12 hours of the game so far, it rules. It lives up to expectation. I'm just in the act one of the game, so it's all content that like people could have been playing by now, and some of it I did play when I checked out the game in early access. But I'm just super impressed so far by the degree of choice and the spiderweb of options that you have. I mean, just like one quest alone might have five different possible endings. And one thing I'm doing with this game is I'm trying not to save scum. I'm just kind of letting the dice fall where they may, which I think is a fun way to experience it.
Yeah, so let me throw something to the two of you that I've been thinking about a lot as I get into this, especially because I recently replayed Divinity Original Sin 2 and was doing a little bit more of a min-max playthrough. And that's that, min-maxing versus just role-playing. And I guess it's something you were kind of getting at there, Jason, where you just let the die lie. You don't save scum and re-roll and just play it out. And yeah, I'm really going to try to commit to doing that in this playthrough as well, just because partly in the spirit of Dungeons & Dragons, which I've been playing as well, and there's no saves coming there. Of course, there is the fact that the DM is forgiving and isn't going to just ruin the game
save
for us all.
Yeah.
There's kind of a fail safe. He'll always give us a way out. But all the same, I feel like I can still kind of trust the game to provide that. And I find often that saves coming as a result of me not really trusting the game to let me have a good time, even if some of my characters get killed, even if something bad happens or I screw up a roll or, you know, I don't convince the person to let me in and have to figure out another way. And I think some of that is because of the transparency that you mentioned earlier about how you watch the dice roll, which is a wonderful thing that I didn't know they did in this game. I figured they'd show you the skill check, but the fact that you actually roll the dice is just perfect. I mean, that is exactly like one of, I think half the reason that my group plays D&D is because we want to get together and roll dice on table and like hear the sound and like see it roll.
I mean, the sound in the game is very satisfying too.
It's great.
It's got like a little sparkly chime for all of your additional points, whatever those are called. I've forgotten that adds
when you
stack
get your,
on
yeah,
top
your
of,
like proficiency yeah. bonuses
yes,
add
yes.
up and
precisely
you get to see the,
where you're like, okay,
number.
I only rolled a 10, but oh, I got a +4 and a +3. And then you're like, yes, made it, cracked the lock or whatever it might be. It just feels very, very exciting and similar to rolling a number on the table that you know is going to add up correctly the same way.
So for what it's worth, there's a setting in the there's a toggle in the settings called Karmic Dice that will like rig the dice a little bit. So if you want them to be truly fair and random, you should turn off that setting. But that setting essentially exists to like prevent streaks of bad luck. But yeah, if you want the real transparency of the dice, you got to turn off Karmic Dice.
That's really interesting. I didn't know about that setting, but I might leave it on because it's almost like them accounting for the fact that the DM will have mercy on you after a little while.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've talked about it because it was kind of controversial and people in the subreddit were upset and were like, oh, I don't want this Karmic Dice. I'm going to turn it off right away. And they like...
I want the pure Larian, objective numbers.
Yeah, probability needs to be real. And like, that's fine if that's how you want to play, but it does sure. only kick in if you get multiple bad rolls in a row, which I feel like does account for the DM in your life who'll be like, okay, you seriously rolled 5 ones today. All right, we're going to have you like comedically fall down this cliff and then stumble upon a chest full of stuff that you need because this is just getting ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some other waiting. As I recall, even if you like get a good roll on the next one due to the karmic dice, the enemies will all be stronger, like to kind of wait out like your luck in some other way. Like you'll have some other bad luck to counteract it. I don't know all of the details under the hood, but I'm leaving karmic dice on. I'm happy to have a friendly DM on my side.
Mm. Agree. So I think it's really neat aesthetically, and it puts me in a mindset like I'm playing D&D, and I think that's really important because it's going to affect how I approach the game because it's just going to feel different, and so I'm going to be more willing to just go with it. And it's made me think more and more about just like transparency of those kinds of systems, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's something that Disco Elysium did really well,
which
too.
I love.
Like it would
so
show
much.
You
yeah.
what kind of dice roll it's doing, and you know whether you passed or failed. Like you were constantly seeing all these roles going on under the hood, which made the game feel alive, not in a like immersive Red Dead Redemption 2 way where they're absolutely hiding all of that from you and you just see this world and you don't really know what's real and what's not. And so you kind of just believe that it's real or some part of your brain does. It's totally the opposite. It's immersive because it's showing you all of the ticking gears and you actually, like I find myself really swept up in that and more willing to like play according to that. To sort of that setup, like to go with it.
Yeah, the kind of the flip side of that is that you just have to trust that the game is not going to be super buggy, which in my experience, I mean, I got a couple of annoying bugs, but mostly is not. I will share one fun story, which is that I was fighting in this big battle and I'm like, I am on a high ground and fighting against a ton of enemies on a low ground. And suddenly goblins begin to appear next to my characters. And for a second I was like, man, is this game bugging out? Like, what the hell is going on here? Are these goblins like teleporting without the game actually telling me? And I was worried that the game, like, again, if you're expecting transparency and the game starts bugging with you in some way, you lose that trust a little bit, right? And that's why it's so important for a game like this. Mm-hmm. Like, you really have to put your faith in it that it's being fair with you and not bugging out and fucking with you. Anyway, so I was trying to figure out, wound up figuring out on my second time trying that same battle that the reason goblins were appearing is because an ogre was throwing barrels at my characters and the barrels were exploding next to the characters and then goblins were in the barrels. And so actually
Amazing.
The goblins are just popping up out of barrels. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's what's going on here. And realizing nice. That was a super fun thing. And I do think, to your point, Kirk, the game not hiding things from you, except when it should hide things from you. Like, sort of, you get into a house and there's someone hiding around the corner. The game should keep that from you. But maybe maybe it'll tell you failed a perception check in the way that in D&D, a DM might ominously say something like that, like, hey, roll a d20. I'm not going to tell you why, but just do it. So there is a level of that kind of opacity required too. But once you trust the game and you trust the DM to give you a good time, you're probably going to have a good time.
Can I ask you, now that you've played as much as you have, would you recommend watching a story recap of the first two games? I know that it stands alone on its own, but I'm guessing, like, even knowing who, you know, where Amn is, or like who Baal is, and some of this basic D&D lore stuff, would that be helpful for people before they play this game?
So I can't really answer that yet, because the first act of the game has absolutely nothing to do with the original Baldur's Gate games. But I can give kind of some broad stuff based on what I know, which is, so this game is set 100 years in the future from Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. You definitely do not need to play Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. There are going to be some references, and it's set in the same universe called the Forgotten Realms of D&D, which some D&D players, a lot of D&D players will know some of that stuff anyway, because a lot of D&D campaigns are set in that world. So the city of Baldur's Gate, for example, is a huge city in that world, and you're going to go and visit that in the game. I also know that there are some returning characters from the first couple of games who are still alive 100 years later and pop up in the game. But I have a feeling that this game is not going to expect you to know that at all. And so far from what I've played, there hasn't even been like the most minor reference that I can see to the original game. So no, I don't think it's super necessary. That said, it can't hurt to go and watch a recap just for fun, and maybe there'll be stuff that pops up later that's connected. In fact, I know there will be, because I haven't even met those characters that are recurring from the first few games yet, but I do not think it's necessary from what I've seen so far. I might change my opinion on that after I played 50 hours, so we'll see. But for now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's 15 minutes or whatever, so it's not a huge ask. If that sounds remotely interesting, you might as well. A thing that it did for me, in addition to just explaining the setting and some of the basics of what happened, it just put me in the mood. It kind of gave me a sense of the types of stories that these games had, since I'd never really played one and didn't know that it's a story of... You're this sort of bastard child of the god of murder. Like, it's a very dark world and kind of full of betrayal and surprising twists. There are characters, I think it's in Baldur's Gate 2, who you meet and you can be an ally with, who then fully betray you and become villains, and a lot of really cool stuff like that. It had really dramatic narrative turns, which is pretty exciting. The whole sort of frequency that the story is on, I think, is cool, and not necessarily what a person might think if they've only seen the video where the guy has sex with a bear. Like, they might not totally have a sense of the world. And if nothing else, I do think a video like that will give you a feel for, all right, what this is like. And I mean, in fairness, also the opening cinematic does the same thing. So
yeah, the opening cinematic's like super gross. Should we say that? Like, I feel like mainly what I was surprised by is how gross it is. Like, you get a tadpole inserted in your eye by eldritch horror, and then you gotta like walk through a sphincter. Like, the doors are called sphincters. I don't know, you're like walking through an alien butthole in order to escape. I don't know why, but you're in like a hell world. You're in a hell
dimension.
Yeah,
it's like gory and dark. I mean, the Forgotten Realms as a general setting are that way, but
it's really messed up there.
These Forgotten Realms are forgotten for a reason,
I say.
There's a lot of lightheartedness. I would say Baldur's Gate 3 feels more lighthearted than the first few games did, even. But yeah, I mean,
It's not Diablo 4 by any stretch, even from the very beginning.
It's Diablo 4 in the sense that it's very sticky and gross looking, and there's a lot of like bodily fluids on the ground, at least at first. But it's not Diablo 4 in the sense that it's D&D in terms of tone and lightheartedness and finding a ragtag group of pals to run with, and maybe those pals will betray me later and I'll take all this back. I don't know.
So we will be jumping into this game in the coming days, and we're going to do a triple play on Baldur's Gate 3 next week when we've all had a chance to give it some proper hours and talk about some of the things we saw and checked out and talk about our characters and our party. We can talk about the party members. Lots to talk about next week. So why don't we take a break for now, and then we'll be back with one more thing.
Hi, everyone. I'm Laura House.
And I'm Annabelle Gurwitch. And sometimes it feels like the whole world is a dumpster fire.
Right? There's too much to worry about.
That's why we make Tiny Victories. It's a 15-minute podcast where we celebrate our minor accomplishments and fleeting joys.
And listeners call in, like Valerie, who found the perfect gift for her daughter's boyfriend, and Adam, who finally turned his couch cushion the right way.
And little happinesses, like how birdsong helps your brain.
That's science. So join us in Not Freaking Out for 15 minutes a week.
That's Tiny Victories with Annabelle and Laura, Mondays on Maximum Fun.
Whew, it's a tiny victory just to make a network promo.
Honestly.
Are you tired of being picked on for only wanting to talk about your cat at parties?
Do you feel as though your friends don't understand the depth of love you have for your guinea pig?
When you look around a room of people, do you wonder if they know sloths only have to eat one leaf a month?
Have you ever dumped someone for saying they're just not an animal person?
Us too.
She's Alexis B. Preston.
She's Ella McLeod.
And we host Comfort Creatures, the show where you can't talk about your pets too much. Animal trivia is our love language. And dragons are just as real as dinosaurs.
Tune in to Comfort Creatures every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, it is time for one more thing. Maddie, what is your one more thing?
I'm playing a game called Pokemon Sleep. Calling it a game is perhaps generous.
Uh-huh.
It's a terrible game, but I have to play every day because it's helping me a lot. And this is my life now, is that I just have to play Pokemon Sleep every day, I guess.
Tell me
more.
It's
improving my life, and I'm not happy about it. So Pokemon Sleep, it was announced a few weeks ago by the Pokemon Company in a really weird live stream where they didn't tell us what it was going to be. And then they were like, yeah, we're releasing a sleep tracking app where you like hang out with a Snorlax and leave your phone on all night while Snorlax sleeps and you sleep. And then when you wake up, a whole bunch of other little Pokemon are sleeping next to Snorlax and you study Aww. Their sleep styles. And I guess if you buy some type of $50 Pokemon Go peripheral, it'll also sync up with Pokemon Go and give you rewards. But I haven't paid $50 for that because I don't want to do that. I'm just using the sleep tracking app. No, it's not going to happen. I can't convince myself to do that. So as far as sleep tracking apps go, I actually really like sleep tracking apps. I've used them for many years. I used to use one called Sleep Cycle before I had a Fitbit, and I have 10 years of sleep data on myself every night for over 10 years wow. via either my Fitbit or Sleep Cycle. And I have charts, I have graphs, I have so much information about how poorly I slept during Gamergate. It's crazy. And no one needs this data. It's completely useless, but I have it and it's there for me. So I was like, all right, sure, I'll try another sleep app. As far as sleep apps go, this one's terrible. It drains your phone battery more than any other app I've tried. You have to leave your phone on all night. Usually sleep apps will let you minimize the app and not have to have it on all the time. Like, for example, you could like tab over to a podcast if you're listening to a podcast in the middle of the night. Can't do that with Pokemon Sleep. If you tab away, it will stop recording your sleep data unless you return to the app and maximize it again. Terrible. The worst. Why is it helping me? Because every morning I have to click on the Pokemon right after I wake up, and it wakes me up to click on the Pokemon. It just does. Okay. Because there's so much game that you have to play right first thing in the morning. Like, you have to make breakfast for Snorlax because he's hungry, and so you have to make him breakfast. And the Pokemon become your friends, and they start collecting berries, and you have to click on the Pokemon, and they give you the berries, and you click on the berries, and then you have to make the berries into a recipe for Snorlax, and you click on that, and you make sure he eats his breakfast, and then you got to click on all your Pokemon, make sure they're leveled up, and then you got to like make sure your Pokemon are like properly allotted, like the right berry collecting Pokemon are all in the lineup, and they're ready for the next night. And by the time you've done that, it's 5 minutes later and you're wide awake. You're wide awake by then. And it has gotten me out of bed so much faster than anything else I've ever done. I hate to admit this. Normally I'm a person who turns my snooze button on and I just roll right over, but this is not that way. You pick up your phone You start clicking on those little Pokemon, you're awake. You're awake before you know it.
I'm glad this is working for you, but this sounds like an absolute nightmare to me.
It is a nightmare, and I do kind of hate it, but also it's so adorable that it's kind of hard to be too mad at it, you know? Like, okay, it's pleasant in the way that a Pokemon game is, and it's extremely gentle, and...
They're very cute,
the Pokemon. So by the end of it, you're like, well, I'm awake. I may as well go for a run. And that's been me, like, every day. And, here we are.
If you don't want to hit the snooze button again, try having a four-year-old come in and jump on your bed every morning.
I can't. I'm not interested in that. I'd rather take care of my Pokemon, Jason.
Like a real-life Pokemon.
Then you have to feed her berries, and you have to assemble her.
And I have to collect the berries every day. So me to do that? I don't know. So I've heard of these alarms that people have where it's like play a game in order to turn off the alarm. This is kind of like that. Although the game, you're opting into it. Like, the alarm is off. You don't need to play the game in order to, like, achieve anything. So I could just stop doing this at any time. But I have to admit it's working so far. So, I don't know. Pokemon Sleep. It's a really stupid app, but it's gotten me out of bed for over a week now. So maybe it's good. I don't know.
Is it?
We'll see if I'm still playing it in a week.
Open question. I'm ambivalent one more thing.
Kirk, what's your one more thing?
My one more thing is a book series that I started reading and am on the third book of, which sounds like a lot, but isn't, because it's a really long series. It's called The Vorkosigan Saga by Lois McMaster Bujold. It's a famous sci-fi, many Nebula, etc. award-winning sci-fi series. Began in 1986, ran through, I think, 2018. Many, many books and short stories, mostly surrounding a character named Miles Vorkosigan, but also his family and his friends. It is very much a swashbuckling sci-fi political space opera. It's really good. It's really entertaining. And I wanted to at least mention that I've started reading it and to recommend the first couple of books that I've read and to sort of explain to people how I'm reading it if anybody wants to give this a shot. So these books, like I said, there's a whole lot of them. The Vorkosigan story. And there's kind of a number of little collections, and they were published in a kind of spread out order. So people go back and forth between whether you should read them in chronological order or internal chronological order, because the books take place on a timeline, but McMaster Bujold published them, you know, in a very different order. So she recommends a sort of internal chronological order. And then I actually found a website that recommends a modified version of her internal chronological order, which I'll link in the show notes.
Love it when you need to do homework to read a book series.
Yeah, this is reminding me of those, like, charts of everything Terry Pratchett's ever written that people upload that are just like a spider web of, like, here's the read order.
Or like when you have to do Buffy and Angel, but switch between the two.
Well, that one's pretty easy. But yeah, I think with this kind of genre stuff, I mean, this is like comic books. I'm surprised neither of you mentioned comics,
I've never read comic books.
This is like when you're in that kind of genre space, people are more into keeping track of this kind of complex stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that some authors just really like, it seems clear that McMaster Bujold just likes being like, I'm going to write a short story. Now I'm going to write the story of Miles's parents. And that's actually, those are the two books that I've read. Collected, they're called Cordelia's Honor, but the names of the books are Shards of Honor and Barayar, which are the story of the actual protagonist of most of the books, Miles Vorkosigan, his parents, how they met, the whole story. It's like this whole complicated story of the sort of politics and infighting on the world of Barayar. It's got war. It's got romance. It has a really amazing love story at the center. Wonderful protagonist, Cordelia. His mother is the sort of point of view character for the first two books. And then Miles takes over. And it's cool to read it this way because I'm kind of reading a prequel that was written by an author who already knew what she needs to set up. Like, for example, there are a bunch of characters in these books who are babies, and there are all these babies being born in various circumstances. And I'm like, oh, all right, so the emperor is just a little child right now. Well, he's going to definitely be emperor by the time Miles is 18 in the first book. So he's going to be a character. And then another girl baby is born. I'm like, oh, but she's going to be interesting. Maybe she'll be a love interest. So you're kind of like meeting the parents of all these characters that you know are going to be really important. And it's just really cool. I haven't really gotten into Miles's story, but I know that a very crucial part of it, I've started The Warrior's Apprentice, is that Miles is born with a number of really serious physical disabilities. Like, his bones don't, like, they break super, super easily. He's a lot shorter than he would be. And it's because there's, like, an attack on his family when his mom is pregnant with him. He almost dies, and, like, they barely manage to save him. And on the planet of Bariar, because they have, like, there was a whole nuclear war and kind of a lot of radioactive fallout, they're really, really terrified of anyone who looks different or has what they consider to be a mutation, even though in his case it's not. It's just, like, there were basically medical procedures that saved his life that allowed him to be born at all. So a lot of people are super intolerant of him, but also he's very powerful because his father is this, like, super powerful guy. So mm-hmm. it's this kind of mix of privilege, but he's also looked down upon.
He's a real Tyrion Lannister type is what it sounds
He's a real Tyrion Lannister type in a lot of ways. He's brilliant and very manipulative and persuasive. He's very good at getting people to do things for him. He has an amazing bodyguard who we've learned his whole very complicated backstory. Anyways, I believe I've seen it said that this series, like, really interestingly deals with disability in general, also with their queer romances and all kinds of different, like, many different cultures that in, like, have relationships that work very differently. The sexual politics of each group are, like, really complicated.
Because there's, like, probably aliens, right? I mean, if it's different planets.
You know, there aren't, and it's kind of interesting. It's
all humans?
It's not clear where everything is. Everyone is humans, but they're all different cultures.
Right.
And Bariar in particular was cut off from the rest of the other sort of civilizations, the other cultures, for this period. I'm forgetting what they call it. It's like they have a name for it. And there was, like, all this warring going on Bariar, and they've then reconnected with everybody. And that's where most of the story takes place. It's where Arl Verkosigan, Miles's father, is a very important, like, Bariaran count who is, like, really tied up with the emperor and all this stuff. So, man, I mean, it's just, like, cool, interesting world building and storytelling. It deals with a lot of really intense stuff. Sexual trauma, violence, repressed memories. It's pretty intense if you just look at what she's talking about. But she maintains a pretty light touch throughout the whole thing. And it never feels exploitative, or at least it hasn't to me yet. Granted, I'm only three books in. I've been surprised at some of the subjects that she's willing to talk about. But it's all just felt like part of the world that she's building. And it really is a fascinating world full of great characters. I don't know. I've really been getting a lot out of it. I think she's a wonderful and very surprising writer. I never know what's going to happen next. And even just those first two books were an incredible setup for what I gather is now going to be a real saga about Miles, about, you know, a character who's not even really in those first two books. But so anyways, I thought I'd throw that down. I know that's a lot, but there's, like, so much more to say about this. I'm guessing neither of you two will ever read it. I really want someone to talk to about these books because Emily, my wife, recommended them.
Yeah, you got to find someone before it inevitably gets adapted into, like, an HBO television show. And then
you're the only person
who's read them all.
It would be really good, at least from what I've read. It would be an incredibly good TV series. It definitely has a lot of, like, exciting action and romance and drama and sex and whatever else. Like, it's, like, very cool and, like, interesting cultures colliding. It seems like it would be a really good show.
Game of Thrones meets Dune. I'm pitching it right now.
Yeah, a little bit. And I'd say, like, a lighter touch than Game of Thrones. Like, it's very, I don't know how to describe it. So anyways, I'm only three books in. There's a million of these. It's really cool. I really like it so far. So that's the Verkosigan saga. I've read Shards of Honor and Bariar. That's where I started, and now I'm on The Warrior's Apprentice, and I'm going to keep reading them. I really like them.
Cool. Okay, my one more thing. I've been secretly watching a TV show called Billions.
Did you know someone was talking about this in the Discord, that actually that was on a bonus episode?
It was.
And so it's we always allude to the fact that I secretly watched Billions, but the real reveal of that, that's for members only.
Yeah,
that's
well, true. A good reason to
be a member if you want to hear
Jason shouting that Kirk is a sociopath and being legitimately affronted for at least a
kind
couple
of horrified.
Minutes.
Although we did remove the paywall for the baby reveal.
That's true.
Do
that.
Yeah, that's true. The war has spilled out into the main feed.
Anyway, I've been rewatching Billions, which is a very fun show to rewatch because
it's a good television show.
I'm at a nice sweet spot where it's been like 4 years since I've watched it last, so I forgot a lot of what happens, and it's a really good show if you don't know what's going to happen. But it's also just an incredibly good, like, well done show in many, many ways. But I wanted to focus specifically on one thing, which is the Ice Juice episode, the episode of the show that is the penultimate episode of season two, where Bobby Axelrod sabotages Ice Juice as I should say, by the way, I'm going to spoil this episode right here. So tune out if you don't want billion spoilers for season two, episode 11.
And honestly, this episode's worth watching, spoiler it free. Is. I'll say this it. Is, this it might is, be I the would greatest say... episode of Billions. Like, it's so
it's definitely
good.
The high point of Billions, I would say. It was having marathoned that whole series, this was it was the peak of the whole show, and it
really
well, it remained fun for a while. This episode is the best, and if you are ever going to watch Billions, you should not be spoiled on it.
If you're ever going to watch Billions, turn off the show right now and watch Billions. And also, why haven't you watched it yet?
Okay. Go watch Billions.
Jason, back to you.
Go secretly watch Billions and surprise all your friends. In this episode is structured. This episode is structured kind of like an Ocean's 11 heist or something like that, which is fitting because I believe the show's co-creators directed Ocean's 13, I believe.
Bing. Just a little point of clarification here as I am editing the episode. Billions was created by Brian Koppelman and David Levien, who wrote the screenplay for Ocean's 13, but of course Ocean's 13, like 12 and 11, was directed by Steven Soderbergh. So just wanted to get those names in there. Okay, back to the episode. Bing!
So yeah, so this episode is directed like a heist, and it's very smartly constructed. It starts off with like the Chiron saying like 3 weeks ago, which is very confusing because you're like, a go from what? And then it jumps around in time from there. You find out that Bobby Axelrod has this master plan to sabotage the juice chain Ice Juice because his rival Chuck Rhodes and Chuck Rhodes' dad have a big financial position in Ice Juice. And if Bobby sabotages it, they will lose a lot of money. And then as the show goes, you see Chuck Rhodes, our main character, played by Paul Giamatti. You see him losing and losing and losing and losing. And you see him kind of, you wonder what his deal is, why he doesn't seem as upset as maybe he should be about losing a whole lot of money. You see his best friend and his father both losing a lot of money as a result of this. And then at the end, the grand reveal, Chuck sitting on a bed in the Harvard Club where he is staying, sitting on a bed, his hands in his eyes, like covering his eyes. You only see the back of his head.
And you think he's sobbing.
He's making these noises. It sounds like he's sobbing. And then the flashback, 3 weeks ago, once again. Then you see his master plan unfold, in which you find out that he was baiting Bobby into doing this the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it's part of his master plan to convince Bobby, to get, like, tease Bobby into doing something super illegal and leaving some loose threads behind so that Chuck can then pull them and unravel the whole scheme and send Bobby to prison, which he has him arrested at the beginning of the next episode. And then after the scheme is unveiled, Kirk, you cut to him laughing. And that's when we see that he was not, in fact, crying. He was cracking up on his bed.
Laughing because it all worked out.
Yes, I can't believe
Bobby is coming back to Billions, guys. I can't believe they got him back. He's coming back. Did you guys know this? You knew this. You knew that.
I had seen it. Yes, yeah, I kind of stopped watching that show though. But
excited about it.
So yeah, so this episode, really a masterpiece in storytelling and just so enjoyable to watch even the second time through. But yeah, Billions in general, just a really fun show to watch again. So if you out there have, whether you have watched it or haven't watched it, consider checking out Billions. But one thing I will add is that our modern streaming world is incredibly annoying. So Showtime as an app doesn't really exist anymore. It's like folded into Paramount Plus. And Paramount Plus, the Billions episodes, a couple of them just randomly, are just super choppy and like unwatchable on Paramount Plus. So I've had to go to Amazon Prime, which also has Billions, to watch those episodes that are choppy on Paramount Plus, because Paramount Plus doesn't actually have a customer support. Like, pretty much nothing these days has actual customer support except for like Amazon. And so Paramount Plus, you can't, and I Googled it. I like checked Reddit. Nobody's really talking about this because like how many people are out there being like, I'm gonna go watch season one of Billions on Paramount Plus. So this thing is super choppy. I even went as far as to DM Paramount Plus on Twitter, but I guess they're not checking it. So yeah, so it just doesn't work on certain episodes of Paramount Plus. Maybe someone out there, maybe a triple click listener who works for Paramount can fix this problem. But anyway, streaming is a pain in the ass. Amazon Prime, at least it works okay on there. Anyway, that's my one more thing. Billions, enjoyable show, very fun to watch. And that is it for this week's episode. Let's go play a ton of Baldur's Gate 3 and then we can talk about it next week. Very excited to hear both of your thoughts and to play some more of that game. In the meantime, Carrie Kamrani, I'll see you both next week.
Yeah, see you both next week.
Bye.
Triple Click is produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the show and also wrote our theme music. Our show art is by Tom DJ. Some of the games and products we talked about on this episode may have been sent to us for free for review consideration. You can find a link to our ethics policy in the show notes. Triple Click is a proud member of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, and if you like our show, we hope you'll consider supporting us by becoming a member at MaximumFun.org/join. Find us on Twitter at TripleClickPod, send email to TripleClick@MaximumFun.org, and find a link to our Discord in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network.
Of artist-owned shows.
Supported.
Directly.
By you.
Doing the math, if there's, say there were 500 megabytes on a CD-ROM when they kind of first came out, there's 122 gigabytes in Baldur's Gate 3. It would be 240. That's uncompressed. I guess that's not accurate. So yeah. You'd be like, Ma, this game is big. It's 200 CDs.
Imagine the manufacturing costs for that game.
Case Logic just books of CDs. Yeah. You're installing it for a whole week before you can
play. Oh my God. And it's a week of active installing because you have to keep going back to your computer.
Keep switching the CDs.
Your install fails on disk 157. You're like, fuck, I'm never going to play this.